right? Oyez, 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 the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. As we mentioned earlier, the court is honored to be here at Baylor University to hear oral arguments for our third time, and the court this morning has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060987, United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company versus Louis Godot from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District, and docket number 061022, Del Lago Partners and Others versus Bradley Smith from Montgomery County and the 10th Court of Appeals District right here in Waco. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will be taking a recess between the arguments. The arguments are being recorded, and the court will post a link to the arguments on our website in the next few days. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060987, United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company versus Louis Godot.
May it please the court, so that you can
argue. May it please the court. My name is David Holman, and I, together with my co-counsel, Wes Tribble, represent USFMG, the petitioner. The interpretation of an insurance policy is a question of law. When the terms used in an insurance policy are unambiguous, the court applies the ordinarily accepted meaning of the terms.
Mr. Holman, does the fact that, as Justice Taft noted here in his opinion, that USFMG took two different positions on the meaning of a term create an ambiguity in itself?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. The way that the Court of Appeals came down on that was that we were taking alternative positions in the summary judgment. We were taking, first of all, a position that he wasn't covered by, that he was, the workers' compensation exclusion applied. And then secondly, that if that wasn't good enough, that he wasn't covered as an insured.
It's like saying, heads I win, tails you lose.
Well, it's two alternative positions, two grounds for summary judgment. The trial court denied the first ground of summary judgment, granted the second ground of summary judgment. What we're here on is the question about whether he was occupying the covered vehicle.
Mr. Holman, will you give the court just a very brief recitation of the facts that underlie the coverage question?
Yes, Your Honor. The facts are undisputed in this case. Mr. Godot was driving his vehicle. He pulled over to the side of the road because there was another vehicle pulled over to the side of the road, and he pulled over to the side of the road to render aid. He got out of his car and was walking between the vehicles when another car came along and hit his vehicle and then spun around and hit the other vehicle and ended up, he was pinned, Mr. Godot was pinned between his vehicle, the other vehicle, and the retaining wall. And the question is whether he was occupying the vehicle at the time of the accident.
Oh, wait, was he pinned between two cars or between one car and the retaining wall?
Actually, as I understand the facts, he was kind of tripoded between all three. The retaining wall, both in both cars.
But the police report and the petition seem to paint competing pictures of what happened.
Yes, I think, and the, we agree that with counsel for the respondent that the petition is not. We don't consider that a judicial admission. The petition is not a sworn pleading, and so we're relying upon the in the police report.
Is there any question that the covered vehicle struck Mr. Godot or not?
No. The way that the police report says it is that he was caught between those cars, those vehicles.
The word upon which I'm sort of having trouble is the word upon.
Yes.
And talk about that briefly. And does it matter whether Godot was upon the covered vehicle after the impact occurred instead of during the impact itself?
That is the key to this case for all of you, because the definition of occupying is in, upon, getting in, on, out, or off. We know that he wasn't in the vehicle because he had exited the vehicle. We know that he wasn't getting in, on, out, or off of the vehicle. The only way that he could be occupying is if he was upon the vehicle.
Was the vehicle still running? Do we know if the ignition had been turned off, door closed, any of those details?
We don't know any of those details. All we do know is that he had parked his vehicle. And that's critical, because what the Court of Appeals and what the respondent are saying is that somehow his being pinned against the vehicle created a causal nexus with the vehicle. And what is important is his vehicle didn't cause the accident. His vehicle was parked. It was only mere happenstance that his vehicle came in contact with him. No average person would consider the fact that he was pinned against the vehicle to mean that he was occupying the vehicle.
We have very broadly construed the term motor vehicle accident. First of all, you'd agree with me, we've never construed what occupying means.
That's true.
But we have very broadly construed the term motor vehicle accident.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very broadly.
Yes.
In situations that perhaps the ordinary person might not think it made logical sense because we favor coverage in this situation. Why would we not broadly construe occupying for the same reason?
When Your Honor is to define motor vehicle accident, as you did in the Texas Farm Bureau versus Sturrock case in 2004, you were looking at a definition that would encompass something that the ordinary citizen could understand, such as a situation where the man had an accident within the vehicle. And you could construe that because in Sturrock, for example, he fell within the vehicle and hurt his leg as falling out of the vehicle.
Well, and we said that the critical was that the vehicle, there was contact between the occupant and the vehicle.
If Your Honor notes, in footnote 12 in the Sturrock opinion, the court reviewed the state of the law with regard to what was covered and what isn't covered in these sort of situations. And the courts, after going through all kinds of jurisdictions under footnote 12, that the critical thing is that if you're within the vehicle or if you're outside the vehicle. And the court pointed out that if you have exited the vehicle, then you're not covered in the vehicle.
But we also emphasize the contact with the vehicle. And there's contact in this case.
Yes, but the contact in this case is a mere fortuity. And that is pointed out in several different cases.
We pointed that out in Sturrock as well, because we said that if he had fallen outside the vehicle, then it wouldn't have been a motor vehicle accident. It was sort of a fortuity that he caught his foot on the vehicle.
That's true, Your Honor. But in this case, there's no question that the vehicle was not the cause of his accident as it was in Sturrock.
In Sturrock, did the policy define motor vehicle accident?
No, it did not.
So we were kind of on our own.
True.
We've got a policy here that defines occupying. So, is that the difference?
I think it is. I think, that we know what the ordinary terms are that you have to define or that you have to apply. And the ordinary term here, the only one that could apply would be upon. And in Texas law, at least, there is a case that talks about upon. It's the Ferguson case, 1963 Waco Court of Appeals case that was a writ refused case. So that would be binding authority in this court. In that case, a woman walking beside the car on a board that broke, reached over, grabbed the car, and then fell. She argued, I was upon the car, therefore I was occupying the car. And the Court of Appeals, later the court recognized the writ refused, the Court of Appeals said, we don't apply a distorted meaning. We don't apply an unreasonably strained construction to the term occupying. And that's what we would be doing in this situation.
Are the appellate courts, either in Texas or around the country, unanimous on what occupy means? Are there cases that are very similar that go different ways? And if there are, is there a majority trend?
Yes. There are cases that you will find going every which way. I mean, there's one case that we found in Mississippi law where if a person's in their bathtub, they could be covered under the occupying provision of the policy. But we have presented the court with some authority, which I call pinned against the vehicle cases. These are the only ones that I found where somebody was actually pinned against the vehicle. And in those cases, the courts are unanimous. We mentioned the case, the Redenauer case, in our brief. And the Redenauer case is a case in which a guy was changing his tires, and he walked around the car and was hit by an uninsured vehicle and pinned against his car. Okay? And he was making the contention, this is Mississippi Supreme Court, he was making the contention before the Michigan Supreme Court that he was upon the vehicle, and therefore he was occupying the vehicle. And the court said no, he had exited the vehicle. And when he was upon the vehicle, it was only a happenstance. And they said, we will not apply an unreasonable construction to the insurance policy. And they used the words, such happenstance does not form a reasonable basis to allow us to understand the scope of coverage.
Why does happenstance or serendipity, upon is upon is upon. Why does it matter how you're upon or why you're upon?
Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to define the words as an ordinary person would define them. And if an ordinary person would not define occupying as being pinned against a vehicle.
Right.
Not
but,
occupying
but
a vehicle.
Occupying is defined by the contract to include upon.
True.
Can it mean more than that? I mean, if you're saying somebody can be upon a vehicle, in the ordinary meaning of what we all think of as being is occupying, of course, occupying is defined as these other words. Can it mean more than what it says in the contract?
Certainly. And the thing is that it has to be a reasonable construction. There's a case, and I mentioned
can't you assume that it's reasonable if the insurance company defined it that way itself and in its own contract?
Well, upon has to be given a reasonable construction. Upon can't mean everything in the world. For example, this case that the tunnel case that I provided the court with additional authority, Tunnel versus Progressive, a pedestrian was walking along the road. Car hit him, dragged him 66 feet down the road. The pedestrian was taking the position, I was upon that vehicle. And the court said, no, we're not going to say you were occupying that vehicle because the only way that you were there is because the accident caused you to be upon that vehicle.
Is it clear that the car that injured Godot was the insured car and not the stranded motorist car?
I don't think it's clear one way or the other. I think, the way it appears in the police report is that he was somehow pinioned between the three different, the retaining wall and the two vehicles.
But since it's summary judgment, we assume their version.
We take all inferences in favor of them. There's a very interesting case that I have provided the court with additional authority, and I would advise the court to read because I think it's directly on point. Last year, the Alabama Supreme Court considered this very question, and that's the Lambert versus Courageous case. And in
identical
that case,
policy?
Same identical policy.
All states, all 50 states, have in a phone, getting in and out, etc. Or is that just our?
I'm sorry.
All states have this getting in or on or out or upon or.
Yes, as far as I've been able to determine under UM coverage, there's some variation in the language, but they all use that term. It used to be in, upon, or entering or alighting from, and now it's the other.
Now it's much clearer.
Much clearer. But the Lambert case was an interesting case because the guy was standing between vehicles, hit by the uninsured vehicle, and pinned against his bumper. And the court said, and he was also taking the position, and the only thing the court was concerned with was whether he was upon the vehicle. And the court reviewed the different case law that I talked about, including the Redenauer case that I talked about earlier. And they said, we are not going to apply strained and twisted reasoning in order to try and find coverage where none exists. We are not going to strain the meaning of occupying in order to create coverage just merely because of the happenstance of him being forced against the bumper of his car.
So why did the Houston court do so?
The Houston court, I think, was confused because of the language in Pearson. The language in Pearson set out a four-part test that talked about reasonable proximity and talked about causation and all of those things. But the interesting thing about Pearson, which the court didn't analyze, was that Pearson looked at it as a process. If you are getting out of the car, then you're covered. If you have gotten out of the car, then you're not. And the reason that the proximity analysis doesn't apply is because there's a famous case, Schultz, that's mentioned in the.
What if though this is also a happenstance? The car is on an incline, and the person gets out of the car, and the emergency brake fails and runs into the putative insurer. That wouldn't mean any is injured and flying on top of the car. That's not a problem.
It's that probably would trigger the liability provisions of the policy. We're talking about the uninsured provisions of policy, and that's. I think that would be a different analysis.
Or a car that's uninsured.
If an uninsured car runs into his vehicle, and he's in the vehicle, then he's covered. If he's out of the vehicle and freely walking away, as was said in the McDonald case or the Fulton case, if he's freely walking away, then he's not covered. Because there's no causative nexus between his use of the vehicle and the accident.
What if it's like that scene from Risky Business? Where the Porsche is like cruising down the dock, Tom Cruise steps on the hood of the car in this futile attempt to like stop the car from cruising down the dock into the water. Is he upon the car?
There's actually a case like that where a guy was trying to fix something in his car and was upon the car, and the court wrestled with the idea and said, well, his legs were off the ground, so I guess he was upon the car. And there have been other courts talk about how to be upon, you have to be supported by, and so those, but. Each case has to be judged on its facts. And the important thing is that the court is going to apply the ordinary meaning as understood by the average person. When you're pinned against the car, you're not occupying the vehicle.
Mr. Holman, take this case, the facts of this case, except presume Mr. Godot was in the bed of the truck when the other vehicle hit him. Would you acknowledge that he would be occupying the vehicle for UIM coverage
under
those facts?
Yes, he would be actually in the vehicle.
But in your view, if he's outside the bed of the truck, even half an inch from touching the vehicle and the incident occurs, he is not occupying the truck.
It depends on, I see my time is up, may I have a moment? If he's in the process of getting out of the car, and he's outside the car, and he's still in the process of getting out of the car, he would be covered. Because it doesn't matter whether he's inside or outside the car. If he's gotten out of the car and he's walking away and he's exited the vehicle and he's on to another mission, he's not
coming. It's a mission.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Kelly. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
And please, the court. Please, the court.
Otto Hewitt for Louis Gudo today. I want to remind the court that we're here in a very specific framework, and that is a traditional summary judgment. And the court is well familiar with the tests and presumptions that apply when we're dealing with a traditional summary judgment motion.
Is there an ambiguity in this policy here? I asked Mr. Holman about the comment that was written by Justice Taft. Different positions that were taken.
I think clearly there is ambiguity here because you have USF&G taking opposite positions. USF&G as defendant saying, "Well, he's not insured, there's no coverage." USF&G intervener says, "Yes, he's insured and there is coverage."
So lawyers do that all the time. Why can't insurance companies?
Well, I know.
is it perhaps because they're interpreting their own policy? Is that why they can't do that?
I think that's correct, Judge, and I think it's more. Actually, the USF&G is more than just a statement and a pleading. USF&G, in responses to requests for admission, we're talking judicial admission here, said that Mr. Gudo was insured and covered under this policy language.
Was that in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Holman says the facts are not disputed. Do you agree
well,
with that?
Well, I agree that the facts are not disputed, but I disagree with his recitation.
What are yours?
Does that get back to the lawyers on both sides of the question? The facts really are undisputed, and that is that Mr. Goudeau was in a covered vehicle. No question the vehicle was covered. Was driving a covered vehicle. He stopped the vehicle to check on another motorist. In other words, he was a good Samaritan, and USF&G's treatment is proof of that old rule about no good deed ever goes unpunished. But Mr. Goudeau got out of the vehicle. How long he was out of the vehicle, summary judgment record aside. How far away he was from the covered vehicle, summary judgment record is silent, although the police report says the inference, as pointed out earlier, the inference is that he was outside the vehicle a matter of seconds, according to the Hart case.
But the sequence of what struck what when...
Well, before you answer that, let me just confirm something, if I may. Is it fair to say it's undisputed that Mr. Goudeau was far enough outside of the truck to walk around to be in front of the truck?
Yes. Okay. The police report has a little diagram, and the police report shows that he'd gotten out and walked actually to the fender.
So it wasn't outside the door, it just stepped out. He had walked around in front of the truck.
I think that's a fair reading of the police report.
Hey, I'm sorry, the justice with the halo had a question.
I'm for Baylor, too, and I recognize that. here's what happened, and here's where I think Mr. Holman probably misspoke himself, because the police report is quite clear about it. The police report says that a third vehicle, the Rodriguez vehicle,
Explorer,
slid in, it was an SUV, slid in and struck Mr. Goudeau, the covered vehicle, the one that Mr. Goudeau had been driving, struck that vehicle, and the striking of that vehicle then slammed the covered vehicle itself. The covered vehicle launched forward, and the covered vehicle itself struck Mr. Goudeau and him against the concrete wall.
So was he tripoded, as Mr. Holman says,
he was
between
not.
Two cars in the wall, or just between the insured covered car? The wall.
He was between the covered car and the wall.
So we've got six terms here. Was he in the covered car?
No, sir. He was not inside.
Was he getting in the covered car?
He was not in process.
Was he getting on the covered car?
No, sir.
Was he getting out of the covered car?
No, sir.
Getting off?
No, sir.
So he has to be upon.
He was on or upon the covered vehicle.
Let me ask you, how important is the temporal aspect of that? I don't have a problem understanding that after he was pinned, he was upon the car or on the car. But the policy says at the time of the accident. And at the time of the accident, how do you argue that he was upon or on the car?
Because at the time of the accident, there was no accident involving Mr. Goudeau until the covered vehicle hit him and smashed him against that concrete wall. That was the instant of the accident involving Mr. Goudeau.
Well, or it was the consequence of the accident. And so I wonder how important those words are that at the time of the accident.
I think we really don't have to go much past your decision in Sturrock. Because in that case, you writing for court said that the covered vehicle had to be a causative factor.
But that was in defining a motor vehicle accident. And it wasn't defining occupying.
Well, that's true, except that the policy language was identical. And the court's reasoning and rationale that the Court of Appeals used is extremely persuasive and really what we think is on point here, because this four-part test, and I'll call it today, I will call it the Charlie Barrow common sense test. The courts use this four-part test, but But the real heart of that, this four-part test, to determine if someone is occupying when they're actually outside the covered vehicle. That's the only time that this, the Barrow test applies. But the real heart of that test is the heart of the Sturrock case, and that is, was the covered vehicle a causative factor in the injury?
But that doesn't seem to square much with the definition, which we have to take a common sense view of.
Yes, sir.
Not just in deference to Justice Barrow.
Yes, sir.
but if the Chief Justice came limping in my office, and I said, oh, my goodness, what's the matter? Where have you been? So I've been occupying my vehicle. I said, well, what were you doing? He said, well, I was upon it. I said, well, what were you doing upon it? Well, walking around on the street. Well, then why are you limping? Well, because something ran into it and hit me. That wouldn't be a common sense description of that set of circumstances, would it?
Here would be, let me answer the question that way. Here, and there, the Hart case, which we've cited in our brief, the 1973 case out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, looked at that. And they looked at this common sense approach, and they looked at the dictionary, they looked at the policy language, which was identical, and the court says that on and upon, they're defined the same. On is upon, near to, and that's where we get to the temporal proximity, on, near to, along the side of, that's the physical proximity, adjacent to, or, and here's the real heart, I think, of the test, the Charlie Barrow test, in contact with. Now, in the Rednauer case, out of Michigan that USF&G relies on heavily, in that case, the contact that caused the injury was a separate car that came by and struck Mr. Rednauer. The covered vehicle didn't strike him and cause any injury at all.
Well, there are a number of other cases, as has been pointed out by Mr. Holman, that seem to go against your view. Are all those cases wrong?
Well, I haven't looked at the four or five new cases. I just got them this morning when Mr. Holman and I were having coffee.
Well, I haven't looked at those. Not just those, but I mean, there's others mentioned.
He's mentioned them. I've mentioned them in my briefing, in my brief on the merits as well.
The McDonald case, for example.
Sir?
The McDonald case. You familiar with that? How do you reconcile that case with this one?
Well, in the McDonald case, you have a situation where the actual covered vehicle itself did not cause the injury. And that's what happened in this case. It's what happened in the Sturrock case. It's what happened in the Hart case.
But your theory is, if you're lying down under the car, working on it, and the car collapses and falls on you, you're upon the car. Even though everybody who hadn't been to law school would think the car is upon you, because the car was a causal connection in your injury. Shouldn't we try to construe policies, because they're not bought by just lawyers, to see what normal people would think. And aren't you leading us into a policy that normal people would think is just not what it said?
Well, sometimes, as Judge pointed out earlier, the law means something a little more, or perhaps a little different than I might use it at Circle K ordering a cup of coffee.
But the causal connection test means you're also covered if the car, if you're under the car.
It would mean under that causal connection test, we're using policy language selected by.
I need a yes or no. If the car falls on you and you're under the car, causal connection test that you're advocating would mean coverage.
Under that four-part test that I've just talked about, you'd be covered.
Well, let me ask you.
Even though you might technically be under it, you'd still be in contact with and
the no question covered about that.
Counsel, your co-counsel said that this language is similar across the country. Is it important for us to
look at how other jurisdictions are, I mean, these are national insurance companies, they're in Texas, they're in California, and everywhere else. Is there any value to looking at what these other jurisdictions say about this question and then deciding whether to join a majority trend one way or the other, or should Texas just go on its own?
Two comments to that, Judge Jefferson. One is that we're dealing with a Texas case, Texas rules, and a Texas test, which we can apply. We don't need to go outside to have some other jurisdiction tell Texas what to do and how to do it. The second thing is, and Mr. Holman, I think, was correct when he said the cases are across the board, across the country. Sometimes the Rednauer case uses something called the rational basis test. And they talk about happenstance and so forth. That's not the test that Texas has ever used.
The Court of Appeals opinion in that regard is kind of odd because it sets out that test and then it says, see these six cases. And then in all six cases that the insured lost, either on summary judgment or otherwise, and doesn't cite a case where the insured won. Is there a case in Texas applying this test in these circumstances in which the insured won?
Yes, sir. We pointed out several of them in our brief. The Hunter case would be one.
Where the insured had gotten out of the car and was walking away.
The Hunter case would be one. The Hart case would be another. We pointed out several. I thought that was a little unusual, but those courts cited by the Court of Appeals in this case, those courts had actually gotten around to sort of defining, here's the test, here are the considerations, and they listed four. And then once one court, and I believe it was the Pearson court, once one court said, well, here's the considerations, well, then all the rest of them just sort of, it was like a crescendo, all the rest of them. Follow the same test.
Your theory, would there be any such situation where coverage ceased to exist?
Absolutely.
How's that? It seems to argue that as long as you're in contact some fashion with the insured vehicle and the insured, no matter how far removed from the vehicle in time and place, there's contact ultimately. There's no breaking of the causal connection.
Well, here's how I would define that. If there is physical contact with the covered vehicle, that would not necessarily be dispositive. Just simple physical contact, like in one of the cases, an individual just kind of leaned over to touch a door handle for some support. That's a simple matter of physical contact. Is not necessarily dispositive, but it is an important and key consideration. The real heart of the matter, though, and I get back to the Sturrock case and a number of other cases, real heart of the matter is whether the covered vehicle, like in Sturrock, played a causal role in the injury.
Okay, we're talking.
Let me add this. The Court of Appeals notes that this was a covered auto, but there's no contention that Mr. Gadeau was either a named insured, a family member, or a designated person. So his position has been that he qualifies as any other person occupying a covered auto. Now, if we take that, if we take your position, logically, you say upon, and you read the definition, means on, adjacent to. Why would not someone walking through a parking lot, walking beside the car, whether they're touching, whether they lean over or not, but walking beside the car, why would that person not be occupying the car if we use your definition and your theory here? Strangers, they're not anywise connected to the car. They're just walking by it on the way to their car or across the street or something.
Well, the policy language itself goes a little further. what you've highlighted, Judge, is the battleground that we're here about today. But the policy language goes a little further in defining who is an insured or covered person. You have to be like an employee in the regular course and scope of your employment and so forth. None of that was really an issue in the trial court or at the court of appeals level. But that's the kind of restriction the insurance policy had in it, so that a person walking past a car might be some way somehow insured. There's no way for that to happen under this underinsured motorist coverage.
But if I'm an insurance company, I say, look, I don't want to insure people where the car falls on them, smushes them. I'm uninsured motorist. I want to, when they're motorists, how do I find it to keep the lawyers from stretching it into something like this? Well, you know, because all cases, uninsured motorists, by definition, it only arises in sympathetic cases because the person's been hurt and there's not insurance to cover their losses. So every one of these is a sympathetic case. And how does an insurer say, no, we mean really in? I mean, what is there, or is that just impossible? We're going to stretch it regardless of what you say.
Well, no, sir. I think it is possible. That would be.
What would you say? What would you have to say that's clearer than what we got here?
Well, I think if an insurance company wanted to restrict it to something like the Rednauer case did, the Rednauer court did up in Michigan, all the insurance company would have to say would be, hey, we're changing the policy, or here's the new policy, and that is, if you are inside the covered vehicle, you are covered under underinsured motorist coverage, and if you are not inside the covered vehicle, you're not covered.
Perhaps they could write an absolute exclusion, for example, say we do not cover mold in any circumstance, something similar to that, right?
That's true, Judge.
Very good.
I'm not.
I read that case.
I'm not completely opposed to the notion that somebody who's either squashed or smushed by a car, they're pinned between a car and a wall, and they're smushed and they're kind of leaning over onto the hood of the car. I can see that as possibly being upon the car, but what I struggle with is whether the upon has to exist when the impact happens, or whether it's okay if the uponness happens after the impact.
You know, Judge, the Hart case dealt with that, basically. And the Hart case says that the insurance company picked this language. The insurance company defined this term. And in this policy, like in the Hart policy, the insurance company didn't put any restriction whatsoever on the use of that phraseology and definition. In fact, they said there's no restriction as to how or in what manner the insured must be on or upon the vehicle for coverage.
But in the first case,
problem is that that's the insurance company made that decision. Excuse me, Judge. I'm sorry.
But just to add to that, in the Hart case, the court said practically the entire weight of the claimant's body was being supported from beneath by the insured car while the claimant was lying upon the fender. If he hadn't walked away, he was actually leaning over onto the car at the time of the accident. Is that true?
I believe that's true, Judge. And how that works, Judge, may I have a second or two to answer? And how that works here is that even if Mr. Goudeau had gotten out of the car, walked around to the front fender, was outside of the car at the moment of injury, at the moment of accident, he was in actual physical contact with the vehicle, and the insured vehicle itself was a cause of the accident because the insured vehicle crushed him against the concrete wall. And so I think this case is even stronger than the Hart case, which did find coverage. We'd ask the court to affirm the
I have one quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
Was upon or on added to the policy? Has it always contained that language, or were those words added?
Historically, it appears that that language has almost always been in the policy for the last 100 years or so. There have been some minor changes, like the word alighting from is no longer used. But the word in, on, and upon, I think, has been used for, I saw cases 40, 50 years old that were using that language.
Any other questions?
Chief, I do have one more question. Counsel, you argued that our Sturrock opinion or position, and Justice O'Neill pointed out that in that case we were defining motor vehicle accident.
Yes, sir.
You still believe that supports your position?
Yes, sir.
Sturrock, we said that if Sturrock had finished exiting the truck and then fell off, or if he had fallen out of the car without any involvement, there would be no coverage.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to cut some of the air out of your sail if you're arguing that Sturrock supports you.
I didn't read the rest of that, because it also comes down and says, reading the policy's terms, which the policy in question was the same as here, reading the policy's terms to exclude coverage for accidents like Sturrock's, where the vehicle itself caused the injury, would render the definition of covered person meaningless. So, yes, if Mr. Goudeau was outside the covered vehicle and this Rodriguez vehicle came up and hit him and knocked him down or hurt him, he's already outside the covered vehicle. The covered vehicle has, the accident itself is not vehicle oriented, to use your beautiful phrase in the Sturrock case. But here, the vehicle itself actually, I mean, for hypothetical discussion, Mr. Goudeau could have been outside of coverage and then come back into coverage when the covered vehicle itself contacted him at the time of the accident, at the time of the injury. He was in actual physical contact with that covered vehicle, and then the covered vehicle smashed him against that concrete wall. And so I think that, much like the Sturrock case, if Mr. Goudeau, like in Sturrock, had already been out and just tripped and fell 2 feet away from the car door, no coverage.
Does it answer your question? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you very much, Judge.
Court will hear rebuttal.
Mr. Holman?
Yes, sir.
On the question of who is an insurer, this is uninsured UIM coverage.
Yes, sir.
And is there any limitation in policy to an employee or someone like that? Because as I understand UIM coverage, if you have a passenger or anyone else, doesn't it cover them, or is there a limitation otherwise?
This was a company car. He was on a mission. He was an employee. He did receive workers' compensation benefits. Under the terms of this policy, the compensation benefits that he got would be set off against whatever he would recover.
Right, but I'm just going to a definition. For example, say we had some exclusion. There's no exclusion for a passenger or someone in the car that they stopped to aid were in the same situation as Mr. Goudeau.
Correct.
We're talking the same question on the definition. Is that correct?
The it has to be a person that's occupying the vehicle.
But that person doesn't have to be an employee in the course of their employment, a family member. It can be a complete stranger.
Passenger.
Stranger.
I don't know about a stranger because
all they have to be is occupying the vehicle.
That's what the Ferguson case goes to. The Ferguson case is the case where the lady steps on the board and reaches over and grabs the car. It wasn't her car. And she's trying to say, I was upon the vehicle, so I'm entitled to coverage. And they said no. That would strain the meaning of the insurance policy.
Upon.
I'm sorry.
Because of the word upon.
Of upon, correct.
And that was the only limitation on coverage, is whether she was upon, not whether she had any prior connection to it.
Yes. In that case, they were talking about specifically the words in and upon. And she contended otherwise. There were a couple of statements made that I just want to correct. The actual language from the police report is, the operator of Unit 2 was caught between Unit 2, Unit 3, and the retaining wall at the time of the first impact. So it was a kind of a tripod situation. Also, I'd like to point out that in the insurance, in the police report itself, it describes Mr. Godot as a pedestrian. The point that Justice O'Neill raised is a point that's been raised in other cases. The idea of whether you were occupying at the time of the accident or whether you were simply struck or whether you were pinned against the vehicle as a consequence of the accident. In fact, the tunnel case where the pedestrian was trying to claim because he was pinioned upon the vehicle for 66 feet, the court said his being in touch with the vehicle was simply a consequence of the accident itself. There's nothing in this, in the facts of this case, that would give any kind of average person the idea that Mr. Godot was occupying the vehicle at the time of the accident. He had left the vehicle. He was outside the vehicle. He was not occupying the vehicle.
Are you familiar with the Allied Mutual Insurance Company versus West National Mutual Insurance Company out of Minnesota?
No, I'm not.
So if somebody is sitting on the hood of a car, the car is struck, they're upon the vehicle for purposes of coverage.
That's the hard case.
But car is struck, and the person comes to rest upon the vehicle after the vehicle struck, not upon it.
Right.
Trying to draw a line where there would be coverage and where there would not be, would it be fair to say that once you have, in some of the cases refer to this, you know, leaving, it's sort of an intent to move away from the vehicle, contact later may not signify coverage, but if the facts make it appear that you're still associated with the vehicle, then perhaps there is coverage.
Yes. And that, I think that's what the Hart and the Hunter cases signify, because in that case, in both cases, the claimant was still in touch with the vehicle, was still in the actual physical contact with the vehicle. He hadn't exited it. Whereas all of the other cases that McDonald discusses, Justice Glenn does a great job of describing the state of the law in this occupying deal, and she goes through all of those cases, the six cases that Justice Heck mentioned. And she points out that the distinction is, if you've exited the vehicle and you're walking freely, then you're not occupying the vehicle. And I think that's the line that you would draw. The consequence that you were talking about is what the Lambert case talked about. They talked about the situation where you have two people, and one gets pinned in the car, another gets pinned against a tree. The guy that's pinned against a tree gets hit right in the tree, doesn't recover, but the other guy does. It doesn't make any sense because that's not occupying the vehicle.
Take a case where somebody is in a covered vehicle, and they get out of the vehicle because they have a flat tire. So they get out and walk around to the back and open the trunk, and they may or may not be touching the vehicle, but they're still associated with the vehicle. Do you think there would be coverage there?
Well, that's the exact, and I see my time is up. That's the exact situation in the Rednauer case. In fact, in Rednauer, the claimant contended that he was 6 inches away from the car. He had just finished changing the tire, and he was 6 inches away from the car, and he was pinned onto the car. He was pinned into the car. The court said, you're not occupied.
If he was pulling the spare tire out?
No, he was not. There's a case
is that enough to associate him with the car?
Yeah, if he's actually in the vehicle, you know, and if he's actually inside the vehicle pulling a tire out, then I think that's a lot closer to occupying the vehicle. But if he's between vehicles, walking away from the vehicle, and that's when he said not occupied.
Chief Matt, one.
Yes, Justice Johnson.
Would you address the request for admission?
Yes, and I meant to address that. I got caught into other things. There were two parties that were named USF&G here. There was the USF&G defendant on the UM policy, and then there was the USF&G intervener in the workers' compensation to get workers' compensation benefits. The workers' compensation intervener named USF&G actually sued USF&G, intervened to try and get subrogation of their workers' benefits. There were two separate parties represented by two different attorneys, and it's always been Texas law that you can't use the admissions of one party against another party.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.